We'll start out, we have a proclamation for Nursing Home Month. Steve, are you going to read that?
Proclamation July 2009, Nursing Home Month. Whereas La Crosse County residents or members of their family are provided affordable, quality nursing care services in a family-like environment, including those whose care may be difficult or those without financial support, and whereas staff is committed to excellence in providing care and rehabilitation to all with respect for the dignity and rights of individuals, including those who have special physical, developmental, and mental health needs, and whereas La Crosse County operates two nursing homes, Hillview Health Care Center and Lakeview Health Care Center, now therefore be it resolved, La Crosse County Board does hereby proclaim the month of July as La Crosse County Nursing Home Month and urges all residents to join in recognizing the valuable contribution of persons dedicated to ensuring quality care to our residents in need.
Moved by Roger Plesha, second by Audrey Cotter. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed no. Carried unanimously. That gets us to the auditor's report. Gary, are you going to lead us
sure.
in that one?
Sure. I have with us tonight two professionals from Clifton Gunnarsson, Renee Messings coming up. She's partner, and also sitting in the side here is Deb Welch, manager. I also want to recognize Sharon Davidson, who does most of the work and coordinates the preparation of the county's annual financial report. So I'll turn it over to Renee.
Thank you. We put a summary in your packets of the entire audit process, and that summary really is very high level. The financial statement document that you've received in its full form is over 150 pages long. So we're happy to answer any questions, but we tried to really bring the highlights of the financial reporting process to you here this evening. The components of your annual comprehensive annual financial report include the transmittal letter, and that's a document that really talks about the background of the government that's written by your administrator. That's followed by the auditor's report, and the auditor's report is referred to as a clean opinion. It says that your financial statements are presented fairly in accordance with generally accepted accounting principles. And that's what the board hires the auditors to determine, and that's what citizens and bondholders are looking for when they read your audit report. That's followed by the management discussion and analysis that provides a summary overview of the financial statements and provides some narrative description that goes along with the financial statements. So it's a little more detailed than the summary you have here tonight, but less detailed than the entire report. And then, of course, you have the financial statements and footnotes, followed by some supplementary information and statistical information. And I do want to recognize your staff. Your report has been submitted to the Government Finance Officers Association's award program. And you did receive the award last year, and we certainly expect that you will receive the award again this year on this report. And it really takes a lot of effort to put the document together in the form that's required to receive that award. So I, again, want to commend your staff on that process. Your financial statements have a number of components, and the first part of those that I wanted to talk about is the governmental funds. The general fund is the part of the operating budget that you're really the most familiar with. It accounts for many of the activities of the general government as well as public safety. There you'll see revenues were $29.4 million compared to expenses of $31 million, or a reduction in your fund balance of $1,675,000. You have fund balance at the end of the year of just over $26 million, and of that you can see reserved and designated funds of $13 million and undesignated funds of $13 million. Now, the county has a policy that says that your undesignated fund balance should remain between 40% and 50% of your annual operating budget. Right now, you're at 44%, so you're well in compliance with your established policy. When you look at in the detail of the report, you'll see some budgetary comparison information for the general fund. That information shows revenues were slightly less than budget by about $477,000. And I did want to mention that the shortfall on the revenue side was really related to the reduction in interest earnings that we all saw as interest rates fell during the 2008 year. On the expense side, your expenses were less than budget by about $4.6 million. and that really represents the fact that you didn't have to utilize all of your contingency funds, and you didn't expend all of your capital outlay, and those funds will then carry over into the 2009 year. The other funds that you see here are additional major funds. Your debt service fund has a fund balance of $1.9 million. Those are funds that have been set aside specifically for payment of long-term debt. And your health and human services fund, you'll see, had almost exactly break-in even operations for 2008 at $28.9 million of revenues and expenses. The fund balance there of $7 million is all designated and held specifically for human services purposes. You have a number of other funds that fall into the governmental funds category. They're aggregated together and referred to as non-major funds in your report. And they include things like your health department, the aging, the jail assessment fund, the library, the old landfill, and your capital projects fund that accounts for the construction of the law enforcement facility. There you'll see revenues were greater than expenses by about $1 million, and you have $8.4 million of fund balance at the end of the year. Again, all restricted for those purposes, but the majority of the funds are held in the capital projects fund of $800,000, the health department $800,000, the old landfill $3.7 million, and the jail assessment fund of $1.1 million. Now, your financial statements really present that governmental information in two different ways. They present it as governmental funds, which is the basis that you see information throughout the year, and it's the basis that you budget on. In addition to that, the Governmental Accounting Standards Board requires you under its statement number 34 to present your financial information in the same manner that a business would present its information. So when you look at the aggregate of those fund balances, which was $43.7 million, to that we add capital assets net of accumulated depreciation of $33 million. We add in some receivables and inventory and the balance of your internal services funds. And we subtract your long-term obligations, and we have net assets on that business-type reporting basis of $125 million. So again, that's bringing in the depreciated cost of your fixed assets and showing the long-term obligations. Now, new in 2008 was a long-term obligation called other post-employment benefits. You conducted an actuarial valuation study for those benefits. Your liability under those benefits is $3.5 million in total. Your financial statements will bring that $3.5 million in over time. In 2008, you've brought in $673,000 of that liability. There's a description of that other post-employment benefit plan and related liability in Note 12 to the financial statements, and so if you want to see more information on that, that you'll find that on page 81. Now, your financial statements also include some activities that are business-type activities of the county, and they include your health care centers of Hillview and Lakeview, as well as the Solid Waste Organization, and in 2008, the Care Management Organization. Those were all major funds, and then you have some non-major funds, again, that are aggregated together. For Hillview, you see that they had revenues in excess of expenses by $955,000. Yes, ma'am.
Could we get page references?
Yes, I'm on page 5 of the handout. Hillview had revenues greater than expenses by $955,000, and it has net assets at the end of the year of $5.7 million. Now, of that, you have about $3.1 million in cash and investments. The balance represents capital assets that are land, buildings, and equipment of the facility. The Lakeview Healthcare Center had revenues greater than expenses of $479,000, and it has
n-
Yes. That includes your tax levy revenue. You have net assets in Lakeview of $3 million. Of that, you'll see cash and investments is $976,000. That means the balance, about $2 million, is land, buildings, and equipment. Certainly, the Lakeview Healthcare Center has received a lot of attention, and in 2009 will have some additional changes in the financial reporting that will affect what you see on an ongoing basis as well as what's in your audit report. The Solid Waste Organization had revenues of $10 million compared to expenses of $16.8 million, or a reduction in its net assets of $6.4 million. I think it's really important to note that most of that loss is related to depreciation of the landfill. You filled one of the cells, and the other one is about 80% full, and so that results in a large amount of depreciation expense during the year. That's about $5.8 million of that loss. So that's a book loss, not a cash loss. That fund has $21 million of cash and investments on hand, and most of those funds are available for capital outlay, continual improvements of the facility, as well as funds that are set aside for eventual post-closure and monitoring costs. The Care Management Organization, you'll see, had revenues less than expenses of $6 million, and that $6 million essentially results in the transfer of the net assets at September 30th to Wisconsin Cares. So that organization took over the operation that formerly was the Care Management Organization, and in 2009, that fund will go away from your county financial statements. The non-major funds include Carroll Heights, Ravenswood, McIntosh, and Regent facilities, as well as your hazardous materials. And there you'll see net assets of $3.8 million, and of that, $2.2 million represents cash and investments. The last set of fund types in your financial statements are internal service funds. And you'll see that you have four different kinds of internal service funds. Your county highway department is operated as an internal service fund, and that really means that it is an operation that provides services to other departments of the county or to the county itself, as well as organizations outside of the county. The highway operations had revenues greater than expenses of $444,000, and it has net assets at the end of the year of $67.7 million. Now, those net assets include land, buildings, and equipment and infrastructure, your highway system. When you look at the cash available in that fund, it's about $3.5 million at the end of the year. But the bulk of the assets in that fund represent capital assets net of depreciation. The next three funds are really represent your self-insurance programs. You're self-insured for workers' compensation, health insurance for your employees, and liability insurance. And there you'll see the workers' compensation fund has a balance of about $800,000 at the end of the year. The health insurance fund has $4.6 million, and the liability insurance fund has $608,000. So those are the pieces of information that represent the financial statements. Now, in addition to preparing an opinion on the financial statements, the auditors also issue a letter that's called an audit communication letter. And this letter talks about certain required communications between the auditors and the county board, and it describes the auditor's responsibility under generally accepted auditing standards. And what that means is that we look at your systems of internal control, we design tests to understand those systems of control, and we test transactions. And we look at the higher risk areas within the county's financial reporting and internal control processing system. So we don't look at every single transaction, although I'm sure sometimes your staff feels that we do. But really, the underlying internal controls are the responsibility of your management, and your management holds those internal controls to a very high standard. That letter also talks about qualitative aspects of accounting policies. It does talk about the fact that there are some estimates in your financial statement preparation process. Those estimates are related to recording liabilities for your self-insurance funds as well as your other post-employment benefits, and also recording the estimated usage on the landfill. Attached to that letter are some representations that we ask your management to provide to us that essentially recognizes that the financial statements are their responsibility. And then the other matters that are included in that letter basically say that there were no disagreements with your management related to accounting policies or principles, and no difficulties in performing the audit. We issued two other letters related to internal control. One of them is required under government audit standards, and the other are some relatively minor recommendations that we've made to your staff for improvements in the system of internal control. The first item is related to segregation of duties related to software access controls. During the 2008 audit, we brought in an internal technology specialist who worked with your technology team in looking at the internal controls related to their operation. And they've recommended that you segregate some of the responsibilities for assigning software access within the system. And your management will be looking at that over the next several months. They've also recommended that you establish a policy of complying with the password changes to your system, as well as access to the data center. You have a proxy card that allows people access to the center, and under the description of who really should have access, there are individuals who have access that normally you would think that they don't have access. And it's my understanding that part of that is related to utilization of a conference room, and that, again, is something that is under advisement and review by the staffs and your management. Related to capital asset accounting, a year ago we recommended that you establish a policy related to capital asset reporting. That was accomplished during 2008, and this recommendation really is related to continuing to refine that policy and bring your full accounting records into compliance with the policy. And then in looking at the documentation of reviews that are performed related to account reconciliations and other controls within your system, we've made suggestions to document some of those reviews and approvals. We know that those things occur, that reviews and approvals do occur within the system. They just aren't documented. So we're recommending here that you just improve that documentation level. And then, again, at the request of your management, we looked at compliance with various policies of the county, and we've made some recommendations. Some of them are related to the timing of cash deposits in each of your departments, also related to accounting for the billing by the Human Services Department, and that is an area that is under review as well as you look to change software systems and improve the ability to record those transactions. In closing my presentation, I just want to say that your accounting records are really maintained in very good order. Your staff does an excellent job of understanding the business of the county, recording those transactions timely and appropriately, doing reconciliations timely, and again, holding the internal control systems to a very high level. Certainly, the audit process is very disruptive to their daily routine, and we really appreciate the cooperation that we receive from them throughout the time frame that we're here. So with that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Anybody have any questions? Terry Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maybe not a question, but Just to let this board know that, at least currently, Clifton Gunderson is also doing the audit for Western Wisconsin CARES, that transition, or maybe not the transition, but that continuity will be there for however, I don't remember how long that contract is, but as a board member of Western Wisconsin CARES, from my perspective, that's a very good thing as I look at this document and know that you guys will be keeping an eye on it on the other side now that it's over there.
There's a lot of institutional knowledge related to the activities of Wisconsin CARES.
And Deb, you're part of that? Thank you.
Good. Maureen Friedland.
Yes, thank you very much. One of the people in my district has been asking me questions for quite a long time about the post-retirement benefits, the GASB 45, and I've attempted to learn something about that and ask some questions, and I've spoken to Sharon Davidson a couple of times about this. His concern is that the county has not funded this obligation. It's not a specific segregated fund, and as I understand from reading the draft report, having the post-retirement benefits in a separate fund would give a higher discount rate. Is it advisable for the county to consider moving in that direction, or is that not necessary?
Well, when you look at the other post-employment benefits that the county has, you're really in a very strong position compared to other governmental units. The benefit that you really provide is to provide health insurance to your retirees where they pay 100% of the premium after retirement. And really what that means then is that your health insurance plan has a blended premium rate, so the retirees pay the same rate as your currently active employees. So if you think about that in terms of the claims that an employee may have, a younger person may have a lower amount of claims, and older person may have a higher amount of claims. So if you had an age-rated plan, that retiree's premium rate would be higher. And so the liability that you have really comes only from the fact that you have that blended rate. So when you compare your liability of $3.5 million to what you might see in other governments, particularly school districts or counties that provided full benefits to retirees and their spouses, sometimes for life, you're in really very strong financial position in terms of this liability. So I think that it is probably appropriate for this county to continue to pay that liability on a pay-as-you-go basis, given that it is a very small number compared to the size of your operations.
Okay. Well, he's compared it to the city's obligation, the city of La Crosse's obligation, which is some $77 million, which is quite a contrast to what the county of La Crosse has. Just a couple of small questions related. What is the annual rate of increase for health care premiums that's assumed? The city's report, I believe, talks about a 6% increase, but I couldn't find anything in our report except for it talks about inflation without saying what the presumed amount is. That's the first question. Then the second question I have is the report uses a closed valuation. It doesn't assume any growth in hirees, but aren't we continuing to expand government and therefore increasing that obligation, and shouldn't that be factored in?
Well, part of your plan is that retirees are really only on your plan until they turn age 65. And so at that point, you have retirees going off as new retirees come on. So I think that has been taken into account in the development of this liability. It's just that you aren't, even though government itself may be continuing to increase, you're not seeing an increase in the number of retirees because you have people coming off of the plan.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Steve, you wanted to add to that?
The other thing that you should be aware of, this is an estimate by actuaries. The fact is that during the entire time I've been here, and I believe prior to my arrival, the retirees, which are segregated into a separate payment account, and their premiums, the cost has never exceeded what the retirees have been paying of 100% of their premiums. In fact, I actually discussed this at length with Gary and the folks that were doing the information afterwards. I respectfully disagree with the estimate of, and I understand the logic of how they came up with that, but our retirees have never cost us more than the premiums they've paid for, because they're paying 100% of those premiums. This is an actuarial estimate of what, because they are older, they should, in theory, cost more than a younger employee, as Renee just mentioned. But the fact is that retirees have never cost us more than what they've paid in premiums as long as we've been segregating that separately.
Okay. And one other thing that I just want to add, part of your question was related to the healthcare cost trend. It's 10%, and it decreases by 1% per year down to 5%.
Thank you very much.
Any other questions? Seeing none, Renee, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Very informative. And also thanks to our staff. Sounds like everybody's doing a good job. That gets us to County Administrator's update.
Just very quickly, just brief updates. If you haven't gotten it in your box or at least on your desk, should be HPL's response to the jail medical review. You'll recall last month you received a copy of the National Commission on Corrections Healthcare recommendations. Included right now is a detailed response. This will be reviewed in discussion with the Judiciary and Law Committee tomorrow. A representative of HPL will be there. I believe it's the gentleman that authored this letter, Andrew Walter. We'll be walking through those and looking at ways to continue to improve jail inmate health care. If you're able to come, I know that'll be a good and important discussion. There are a number of issues that HPL has identified that they can continue to improve and ways that we can enhance the level of service there. But I wanted to point that out because 2:30 tomorrow, I'm sorry, it's the primary agenda item, so it'll be the probably the majority of that meeting. And then, of course, if there are changes or improvements to the scope of the contract that come out of recommendation from Judiciary and Law, that will come back to the County Board. So just wanted to keep you in the loop there. The budget, as you know, has been adopted by the state and signed by the governor with some items that were changed. Included in your monthly county board report that you get from the administrator's office is a very good detail on human services, which is the biggest impact. Probably, again, the most positive news is that each one of those impacts will be in the 2010 and 11 budget, not meeting an impact to us in the 2009 budget. That's also true, as I shared with you, the impact on shared revenue will be in the 2010 budget in 2011. We're identifying each one of those additional items, and we'll keep bringing those back to you. There were a couple of changes that we're just discovering in how the governor impacted the his line item vetoes, but the majority of what we've already reported to you is the impact. We'll give you a more detailed report. As we start to bring you the 2010 budget issues, we've identified a number of those for you just to keep them on your horizon, and we'll keep bringing them back to you in case you identify anything in particular. They include the human services restructuring and addressing the state budget cuts. The Mental Health Crisis Center will be a significant budget issue that you'll be dealing with this year. Lakeview levies reduction and capital plan and ongoing finances will continue to be a significant budget item. Uses of fund balance, other program cuts that may be necessary, as well as ongoing tipping fees and that impact to your users and to local haulers as well as communities will be a big issue. And, of course, personnel items will continue to be an ongoing issue. So we'll start to bring you some of those in August and September, even prior to completion of the administrator's budget document, because I want to make sure that you're in the loop on the major budget impact items. Also, you may have noticed on the La Crosse Tribune website earlier today, there was an attempted suicide in the jail. It was hampered by both inmates and jailers. It is something that unfortunately happens occasionally. We weren't expecting media coverage on that, but again, it was not successful. It was stopped. This was a couple days ago, but it was covered in the newspaper today. And I visited with the sheriff about it. The good news, again, is that it was stopped. Occasionally, those kinds of things happen in the jail. And what's good is that with the changes we made historically with the smoke detectors and some of the other things that had made it easier for someone to succeed previously, but the cameras and everything that we're doing is making it a much more difficult thing for someone to succeed at, and so you may have seen that on the La Crosse Tribune site today, but Steve asked that I touch on that as well. That'll probably be something that we may even discuss at Judiciary and Law tomorrow, just under jail medical issues.
Questions for Steve? Jill Billings?
Will Sheriff Helgeson be at the J&L
Judiciary
and Law meeting tomorrow?
Almost certainly.
Thank you.
Chair Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sorry, I've been out of town. Did the governor do anything with tipping fees?
He left it where it was passed, so it's a $7 increase net.
Okay.
It's more complicated than that, as Public Works just learned.
But he didn't do anything with it.
He did not change those.
Okay, thank you.
Anybody else? Okay. That gets us to Gary Ingvaldson talking about comprehensive review of scope of services provided by FOTH.
Okay, with the change in leadership at the end of 08 and into 09 at Solid Waste, Steve O'Malley, County Administrator, requested that myself and Dave Lang do a thorough review of the FOTH contract. You received some PowerPoint slides in your agenda. Also have it up there on the screen. Believe it or not, I think engineers and lawyers are even more detailed than accountants, because the contract, and actually it's the first time I had actually looked at the contract, but the contract is very detailed. It actually has 28 or 29 sections. You have the subcategories listed up there on your screen and in your agenda packet. There's specific areas that Dave and I looked at. Well, frankly, we looked at all of them. A couple of ones that I want to highlight. One is the insurance. When we did the RFP a few years ago for this contract, we made sure that the liability was to be borne by the consultants. We felt that if for some reason they made a mistake, we wanted to make sure that that the buck would stop with them as opposed to La Crosse County. And within the contract itself, the FOTH has professional liability coverage for $5 million. So that's pretty important to remember that. Some other things as far as the terms of the contract, it was 5 years, starting in year 2006, five-year contract with the possible 2 1-year renewals. But that would have to come back to the committee. Another couple of things I might want to highlight towards the end, it talks about other consultants. What that means is that on occasion, FOTH will actually subcontract with other consultants, particularly if there's a local firm that does surveying work, for example, they have utilized them. So anyway, Dave and I went through the contract with a fine-tooth comb, and by the way, it wasn't just ourselves. Actually, the Hank, the solid waste manager, and then the new person in charge of La Crosse County's account, Jim Miles, with FOTH, was also, of course, involved with the review. Speaking about Jim Miles, you'll see on this next slide that Jim is the project manager for La Crosse County's account. One reason why we have this slide up there is we want to point out that even though we've been fortunate enough to find a person of Hank's caliber to be our new solid waste director, it's important to remember that FOTH has a wider range of specialties on their staff. They have mechanical engineers, civil engineers, geologists, engineers with chemistry majors, engineers with preventive medicine emphasis. They also have a marketing and communication specialist. So Hank can't do everything by himself. He relies on both experts in special fields. And I'd also like to comment that another thing that Dave and I discovered when we were reviewing their contract is both really specializes in government and public solid waste facilities. About 90% of their business is on the public end, so they can relate real well to our business.
Gary, I have a quick question for you. When Hank was with Foth, was he on this chart somewhere?
Yes. In fact, he was at the top where Jim Miles is.
Okay, that would have been his position.
Yes,
okay,
exactly.
Thank you.
Hank, by the way, is here tonight, too, if anybody has any questions of Hank. Some of the things that we went through, Dave and I reviewed, along with Hank and Jim Miles, the active projects. We also went through the process of how invoices and POs are approved. Of course, you know, that was done by the previous solid waste director, but Dave and I got an in-depth look at the checks and balances that go into paying invoices. In fact, I now am even more involved than I was before, and Hank will continue to keep me involved with the approval of projects and invoices and POs as we go throughout the year. I talked a little bit about the fact that Foth has an emphasis with public solid waste entities. We talked a little bit about 2010 budget issues. We also talked about Foth's emphasis on they stress really three areas: economic goals for their clients, environmental goals for their clients, and society goals for their clients. Another thing that we discovered is that Foth will really tailor their services by client. Some of their clients, for example, do not have a professional engineer on staff, like Hank is a professional engineer. Some clients might only have two people in their department. So in those cases, they're going to provide more services to that entity than they will for us. Jim Miles was very willing and open to talking about how can La Crosse County save some money now that we do have a professional engineer on our staff, and I'll get into that in just a little bit. I want to mention again that Foth was selected in 2005 from an RFP process. It was coordinated by Brian Joseph, purchasing manager. There were six individuals that ranked the responders: solid waste director, solid waste operations manager, Dave Lang, Sharon Davidson in my department, the Houston County Recycling Manager, and the City of La Crosse Public Works Director. So frankly, there were only two solid waste people, La Crosse County solid waste people on this selection team. The rest had indirect involvement. We also reviewed and found that Foth has consistently been under budget every year. And through recommendations from Foth, they have been able to save the county money.
Hey, John.
Okay.
Keep going.
One thing Hank actually did for us so that Dave and I could better understand the contract, because it is a significant contract, he broke it out into contract management categories. There were four categories along the top. One is compliance, the other is construction, another one is operations, and the last one is voluntary other. He then broke down the specific projects for 2009, going down the left-hand side of the page, and also indicated whether or not La Crosse County has approved that specific project, whether it's on hold, and so forth and so on. Towards the far right-hand side, it illustrates the total estimated cost, and it also illustrates what we had actually budgeted. For 2009, we budgeted $681,000. We plan on spending only $443,000, although that could change before the end of the year. The biggest one, there's the $200,000 for the ash monofill vertical expansion. That's on hold. So that one we don't plan on spending in 2009. Going on to the next page, I again touched on it this earlier. We spent a fair amount of time with Hank and Jim Miles in regard to now that we do have a professional engineer on staff, how can we save the county some money? In the second column to the from the right-hand side, proposed to be provided by the county, you'll see there's a total of $40,000 that we will be saving by the county doing some of the work that Foth had originally planned on doing. And it's some of this isn't only specific to work that solid waste would have been doing. For example, the compliance tracking system. Actually, IT is going to be able to, John Parcells' department is going to be able to create some spreadsheet that Foth had been managing and developed in the past. John will be able to do that in the future. So again, it's a team effort of various departments pulling together. As Hank just mentioned in the Public Works Committee, it is really a team effort. It's Hank and the Highway Department and Dave Lang, Facilities, and the Finance Department. I also want to mention and acknowledge that Denny Osgood was involved in this review also, and certainly everybody appreciates the amount of extra time and expertise that Denny provided as an interim. Denny took the bull by the horns when he stepped in as interim director and was able to even make some positive changes even before Hank's arrival that have saved the county money. So I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
Any questions for Gary, or Hank is out there if anybody has any questions for him. John Menninger.
I believe it's Green Bay. Is that correct? Or? Yes, it's Green Bay.
Terry Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the chart on page that's not numbered, the one both provide services in a variety of areas.
Sure.
So if you take out the $200,000 for the monofill vertical expansion that's on hold, that 443 really compares then to 481. Is that
sure?
That's the effect
yes.
of what you were saying.
Correct.
Then how does that number 481? Excuse me. How does that compare with other recent years? I mean, is that about in the ballpark of the amount of business we do with both on an annual basis?
I didn't bring that file with me. Do you know off the top of your head, Hank, how that compares with prior years?
Having been your client liaison in past years, this is down about $100,000 to $200,000. Typically, we were $600,000, $700,000, $800,000 in past years because of the very aggressive construction schedule you had at your landfill.
And then I don't know if this is Gary or Hank, but the 2005 RFP process was for what length of time?
The contract was for 5 years with an additional 2 1-year renewals.
And was that what we had before? Did we have a 5-year contract in 2000 or in 98 and then 2 1-years after that?
I don't know. I'm
love
not sure.
Asking questions.
Yeah, you sure do. Yes.
Dave has an answer for you.
Stop me. I will find out for you.
Dave maybe knows.
I'm not sure. I think it was 7, but I can double check it. I think it was 7 years before,
okay.
But I can double check.
So when was the last time La Crosse County contracted with an engineering for these mm-hmm. services other than Foth?
Well, we had errors at one time.
We had errors and associates.
And how long ago was
that? I think between 10 and 15 years ago. I know because we were involved in a lawsuit with, it was Terra, and I think that was in the late 90s.
Yes, I believe so.
Okay, then the last one is the three goals that Foth works mm-hmm. with their clients on. It was economic, environmental, societal.
Correct.
In that order.
I guess I might rely on Hank again. I mean, is there a priority in those three?
Is that our priority level, or is that Foth's priority level? I guess is what I'm wondering.
Those three goals are the three sustainable circles that you've seen, mm-hmm. where they try and bring together economics, environments, and people. And so Foth has been involved in sustainability for a long time. They apply those goals to their people and say that, even if this project is economically right, if it doesn't serve the county environmentally, if it isn't right for the people, then it's not a winning project.
But and is it fair to say that part of the work that FOTH does is help primarily public, as we heard Gary say, because it's 90% of their business, is to help their clients also believe in those three circles and help them manage or balance those three through education, through
in the solid waste area? FOTH's main brand was helping you compete. And FOTH in 97 turned away from the private sector in solid waste management and decided to align themselves with the public sector and help them compete. And that has been their driving force since the late 90s. The sustainable, applying the concepts of sustainability to the solid waste occurred in about the last 4 years, and they realized that if you didn't have all three things, if you didn't have the public part of it, if you didn't have the environment, and you didn't have the economic, then it typically wasn't a winning project for the client.
Thank you.
Brad Paff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Hank, if I can ask you a couple questions, please. At the landfill, we have methane that's being burnt off, correct?
Yes.
Can you briefly tell me why it's being burnt off?
Yes. We don't have enough. That's one of the biggest problems. We discussed that with the Public Works and Infrastructure Committee, gave them an update tonight on this. The county has won a grant to study the feasible alternatives for recovering that gas and producing energy. And we found two things with your facility. Number one, you take out the high carbon content of your waste and burn it at the waste energy plant. And we're finding that your waste, as it's delivered to the landfill, after that's been segregated and burned off, has one-tenth the methane generation potential of other landfills.
Well, that's the second question I was going to ask you then. As an engineer, could you change the waste mixture in order to create more methane in order to create energy?
That would actually hurt you, because when you rely on the landfill, which is not a very controlled device to digest that and produce the gas, the collection efficiencies of your gas aren't as good as the burning efficiencies in a plant. In fact, a lot of environmentalists and a lot of government organizations right now are very opposed to saying that extracting the gas from landfills is as effective as waste energy. Waste to energy is the preferred alternative. And so what you're doing is you're actually getting more energy from your waste with your system than you are at the waste managements and other places that simply dump it in the ground and collect it that way.
Thank you. If I can follow up, is there, thinking outside of the box, is there anything that can be done besides just burning this off? Is there such a thing as greenhouses and having hothouse tomatoes? Can something be done besides burning this off?
A couple things. That feasibility study and grant that you will look at some of these alternative technologies. And one of the things that was approved tonight by the Public Works and Infrastructure Committee was putting in coils in the new shop that will be developed that some of this gas could be burned to heat the floor of that shop. Also, the infrared heaters that are going to be in that shop were specified to operate on landfill gas. So while we may not have a big project, we're still looking at having some useful smaller projects at that site.
Very good. Now let me ask you, are you familiar with the term carbon sequestration?
Yes.
Is there a way for that landfill in the future to sequester carbon and capture dollars?
No.
Explain.
Too small of a project.
Okay.
It's just too inconsequential compared to the massive projects and financial involvement and the fact that they haven't even proved carbon sequestration.
Right. I understand. I mean, I understand that. But will that be part of your grant application, or is that's only for the methane capturing?
Won't waste your money studying it.
Okay.
We might talk about it, but we won't waste your money studying it.
I know you're a smart man, but keep an open mind and keep moving forward. Thank you.
Tom Rauch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Gary, I think you alluded to this, and I didn't quite digest it well enough. On the transition of services chart, where you talk about the services proposed to be provided to the county, $40,000 worth, mm-hmm. who's going to be doing that within the county then?
Hank will probably be doing the majority of that, but again, for that compliance tracking, the majority of that will be done by the IT department.
Thank you.
Jim Burns.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question for Mr. Cook, and it involves the new position as a department head of La Crosse County. I recognize a tremendous upside to having Mr. Cook as our solid waste director. I've already seen, being on the committee, I've seen some excellent things and ideas coming from Mr. Cook, and I really appreciate that, and it's I'm impressed so far. I guess my question is this. I know, recognizing there's a big upside, having an engineer and person of your expertise with us, with the county, my question is, do you anticipate any potential conflicts of interest involving our relationship with FOTH or any other contractor that you've had relationships with? And I guess if you do anticipate a conflict of interest, how would you suggest, how would you handle that, or how should the county, maybe there isn't going to be a conflict of interest, but I guess being that you were formerly in the private sector and you were consulting the county and you work for FOTH, are there any potential conflicts of interest?
I haven't seen any. That's something that, you know, certainly we've discussed with people in finance and people in the Corporation Council office. I would certainly make them aware if I thought I felt anything that way. Prior to taking this position and prior to my working for FOTH, I managed them as a consultant when I was in the private sector. And so this is not hard for me. This is very easy. I managed lots of other consultants. I've managed lots of contractors across the state and have worked with them. I actually have less of a conflict now being a county employee than I had in some other positions. And so I think this is actually going to be easier for me.
Thank you. Thank you.
Steve, I'd like you to address that question also, because I know that has come up. People just want to be assured that you're monitoring any issues that could come up.
Well, certainly that was the primary purpose of doing this complete review. In addition to that, before Hank came on board, he voluntarily divested himself of any stock in FOTH, which was much less than 1%. Our actual ordinance would require him to only inform us if he had 10% of a company that did work with us. He has divested himself entirely of that stock and no longer has any financial interest in FOTH, and that was something that Hank voluntarily agreed to right away, and was something that gave me reassurance that he has no vested interest in FOTH. And I also wanted to make sure that we were as clear as possible by this review on exactly what FOTH's responsibilities are, and at the earliest possible date that either the Public Works Committee or County Board wants to proceed with an additional RFP for new services, we can always do that as we conclude these contracts to make sure that there is no potential for conflict.
Maureen Friedland.
Yes, thank you. I'm also very grateful that this review was done. I think it was important to look and understand exactly what the FOTH contract is, and it's interesting to hear that even council had difficulty going through this contract and really understanding all the pieces of it. And I do know that Hank has agreed to divest himself of stock ownership, and I heard Gary say that FOTH has been under budget each year and has saved the county money, and I think that those are tremendous assets that we have going for us. But in light of the fact that Hank was involved in this contract before as in the same position as Jim Miles Polka was, I wonder if perhaps independent review of this isn't warranted, in addition to county people or Hank Cook being looking into the contract to see if there's any if there's been overutilization or if there's any areas of where we can save some money. If maybe someone a little more independent or further away, someone who understands the contract pretty well, might be looking at this also, if that would behoove us in some way.
Dave?
I don't know, Maureen, if that would do that much good. I mean, I'm familiar with it enough, and the main part or part of it would be in the scope of services or what services are being utilized. And you know, even if you had someone independent, unless it was someone who just worked a lot in this area, it would have to be probably not even an attorney, but someone who works in the area, maybe even another consultant. And I just don't know if that would do much. I mean, I've looked at it, and I really don't see where it would be that beneficial. I know what you're saying, but as far as the contract terms, I don't think so, because that we negotiate out a while back, and I'm familiar enough with that. As far as the actual services, I just don't know if it'd be that beneficial.
Okay. Well, I agree with Supervisor Burns that Mr. Cook's ability and background is a tremendous asset, and I know he'll be working for the county as we go forward. And I appreciate that this report was done, because I think there were some questions as to whether we were spending too much in the contract or not. So I think it's very good that we did this, that you all did this review, and I think it's just really helpful, and it clears the air to a great degree. And I thank you all for doing this.
Back to Tara Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a friendly suggestion to Hank that, and I'm thinking of your answers to Supervisor Paff's questions. There were several times when you said "your," and I would encourage you to change that to "our," now that you're an employee of La Crosse County.
Gary.
I need to correct myself in regard to my answer to Mr. Rauch's question about the transitional services and who will they be performed by. I said that the compliance tracking would be primarily done by IT. Frankly, IT will set up a program to allow Hank's staff and Hank to do that tracking.
Any other questions? Ralph Gary.
Thank you. If they do an RFP at some point in time, is the composition of the committee going to be different?
I mean, we're always open.
I mean, would Hank sit on it?
Oh, certainly.
As a solid waste director? Would it be somebody else?
Well, no, I mean,
again, it would be at the direction of the Public Works Committee. We, at the time that we go back through an RFP, we come back through your process and get your input and direction, as well as obviously the contract comes back through Public Works and on to the full county board. So it's subject to your scrutiny and direction.
Anybody else? Any other questions or comments? All right. Thank you very much. That gets us to got an interesting report coming up from Charlie Handy, our county planner, on vacant residential lots in La Crosse County.
I can see the fear in their eyes. They've got a tie on. They're in trouble. That's the negative effect of having Brian in the office as I'm dressing up. So this is try to keep this fairly brief. We've been over the past couple years attempting to gather information on how many vacant lots there were in La Crosse County, and a couple years ago we did a visual survey. As you know, we have a very good geographic information system that my boss, Jeff Blusky, has managed over the years. So a couple years ago, we took the aerial photos, which are fairly up to date, and we took a look at the aerial photos, and we did a survey of how many vacant lots we thought that we as a staff saw in those aerial photos. And that number was around 1,200 vacant residential lots, which really surprised us. We thought that was a pretty high number. And so since that time, we've been taking a look at the data and trying to figure out how we can have a little bit more accurate assessment of how many vacant lots there are in La Crosse County. And we felt the information was important. So what we did is we took the GIS system, and every plat, which in legal terms is a final plat, and that's a major subdivision in La Crosse County, is recorded on the GIS system and also in the Register of Deeds office, and every certified survey map, which is a minor subdivision, is recorded. So we have very good data on the subdivision of land in La Crosse County. That includes incorporated and unincorporated areas. And then that geographic data is available in both the map, the geographic form, and the tabular data or a table. The other thing that we have information on is we have a very good tax system that's been developed over the years by the assessment office, which is basically Jeff is the director and Pam Hallnagel. Those assessed values are on two different things, on land and on improvements. And so what we have is we have a land value of X, and if we have an improvement value of zero, then we have an idea that that lot is vacant. And so what we did is we cross-referenced those two tables, and we came up with the data that's included in this document. So if you want to flip to the next page. In your handout, I've got two pages on per or is this something I can do? There you go. Good job. There we go. Why? Why did we do this? As you know, we've completed the comprehensive planning process, and it's really important to have good baseline data so that as we go from the start of the comprehensive plan, every year we're going to do this assessment of how many vacant lots there are in La Crosse County. There's a lot of other data that we're collecting, and as planners, this is interesting stuff, and as many other people, especially my wife, it's very boring. But it's going to be real important to have this data to make good land use decisions as you move forward. And so this is the first run at it. This is your baseline. This is where you're going to start from, hopefully, with the 2009 data. The other thing to understand is from the day that we started collecting this data to the day that we kind of finalized it, which was late last week, it changed. It's constantly changing. We're constantly getting new building permits. We're constantly getting changes in assessed values, land splits, and things like that, subdivision of land. So we got to take a snapshot in time. We got to cut it off and say this is the date that we're using this data of, and then we'll go next year and try to get a very similar date so you get very similar data. So for the comprehensive plan, we can start to see patterns, and it'll be valuable for both the public and private sector. I think this is really key to this presentation. The first thing that I did with this data was take it to the Builders Association, because this affects them directly. And the Builders Association was actually very surprised at this data also. This is their livelihood. And so we had a very frank discussion about how this affects them and their concerns about bringing this forward for policy discussions at a local government level and how they can be of assistance in having that conversation, and maybe even we can have more of a private fix to this rather than just a public fix. And so that conversation is already happening, and I think that's real important that you know that. The other point I think that's important is we've had a significant change in the economy. Yeah, I'm Captain Obvious right here. And that significant change in the economy has really affected our building industry. And we're lucky in La Crosse County that we're a bit insulated from that, but obviously by these numbers, not very well insulated from that. So that's very important that we're studying this data now so that we can see what happened because of this downturn in the economy and where we should go from there. It also will assist us in updating our zoning and subdivision codes. That's something that we're working on as a staff right now. So then you turn the page. What's the economic impact? We're going to keep this really simple. Economics 101, the law of supply and demand. And if the supply is way up, which it is, the demand is down, which it is, what's going to happen? The obvious thing is that the value of land prices, et cetera, will be depressed. This is bad for builders, bad for developers, bad for bankers. It significantly affects their market, but it's also bad for local government, and we'll talk about a couple of those things. Steve has said many times about the study that was done for us by Kim Lee Horn. I was going to say Yagi Colby, but they're both funny names. Kim Lee Horn on the road study, $20 million in unmet road needs, and you know that's obvious when you drive the county roads. The sprawling development patterns are less efficient to serve with public facilities, and I'll show you a couple examples in pictures coming up, and that there's a lot of infrastructure that's built to do a full-blown subdivision. If you're going to do 100 lots, you got to do roads and sewer and water and everything to all of those lots, and then if those subdivisions are not filling up at the pace that the developer would like them to fill it up. They're also not filling out at the pace that we would like them to fill up. So we've got to drive all the way down those roads to the end of those roads to serve one house at the end or two houses at the end or five, and we'll take a look at the next couple slides. This is Rockland. We're actually meeting with the Village of Rockland tomorrow night to discuss a possible financing options. This is Meadow Park Estates. It's more than 100 lots in the Village of Rockland. And what Rockland did that worked for them very well in their last subdivision, which was about 15 lots, was they invested in the infrastructure themselves. The developer paid for the land and other things, and the village paid for the public infrastructure, and basically then charged that infrastructure back to that lot when it was purchased as a special assessment. Now, because of the significant investment in just land that the developer made, sarcasm intended, the developer is not doing well and potentially going into receivership or bankruptcy or whatever legal status. We're unsure of that, but the understanding that the Village of Rockland sees a significant concern gives us an understanding that that's probably likely to happen. So what happens? This property, I believe, is 2 years tax delinquent. Another year or two, it becomes 3 years, 4 years tax delinquent. Guess who gets it? La Crosse County. And then the discussion goes to, and this will be a good question for you, Dave, to look at fairly quickly here, is what happens to those special assessments? It's approximately $750,000 in investments that the village has made in public infrastructure that are special assessments, that are taxes that are owed, and who gets those? So this is gives you an example, and you can flip to the next slide, of why we should, as public servants, be concerned with this. If you look at that subdivision, you can see on the south the rest area and the interstate, and on the north the bike trail and the railroad tracks, and in between then is approximately 100 lots. And yes, if you look at the dark spot in the middle of the light on the upper right, that is the house that's developed in that subdivision. This is a 2008 aerial photo. So significant concern with that potential. Okay, go ahead and go to the next one. This is a Rivendell subdivision in the town of Onalaska. Again, potential to be in receivership or bankruptcy. We had the lot developer come in and looking for rezoning on a couple of lots to duplexes. His check for $370 or whatever it was for rezoning bounced. So it's a difficult situation. We don't know exactly where he's at in his financial position. But again, you can see the sign, and you can see the area behind it, and you can flip to the next slide. Again, this is a 2008 aerial photo, and you'll see two houses in that subdivision. So, yeah, this is Bryce Prairie. You can flip to the next slide. This is Ridgeview Estates, or Ridgeview Heights, up in the town of Greenfield. And it's kind of tough to see, but on the bottom is Highway 33, that kind of horseshoe shape. And then you see the farm that's in between Highway 33 and Ridgeview Estates. The farmhouse, and if you ever went up to the restaurant, is right off of that first road. And then down to the right.
You can use a laser.
Okay.
That one right there. Yeah.
That's the sewer treatment plant that they had for the restaurant that they closed before they started developing the subdivision. This is the farmhouse. So what you'll see is one house, two house, three house, four house, five house, six, seven, eight, nine, 10, 11, 12. Six are here. The entrance to the subdivision is here. It gives you a real typical idea of what happens. If I'm going to go in that subdivision and buy a house, I'm going to do the same thing. I'm going to buy the house furthest from the road, which means we have to provide public services the entire length of the facility. House on a cul-de-sac, house on a cul-de-sac, house on a cul-de-sac. That's where they go, and that's the first thing that happens. So it's a concern. It's a tax-based issue, etc. Go ahead and flip it. This is a map of those lots. The yellow dots are the subdivided lots. with zero improvement value in La Crosse County. And as you can see, it's not really picky on the map where it is. It's everywhere. There's certainly less in Burns and Bangor and Washington, but they have some. Obviously, you can see Rockland is the cluster here. We were looking at Rivendell, which is in the town of Onalaska, Bryce Prairie here, and then Ridgeview Heights is this one right here. So it gives you an idea of where they are and how prolific this issue is. You can go on to the next one. We have a total of 2,473 vacant lots in La Crosse County. That number might vary a little bit. We took another 27 off last week. But we've gone through that data pretty thoroughly. We've really taken a look at it and made sure that we're not making mistakes here because we were so surprised at the number. The incorporated area is actually in quite a bit better shape. They have 1,100 lots in the cities, the two cities and the four villages. The unincorporated areas is where we really think there's a concern, 1,373 lots. 40% of the lots of all of those 2,473 lots are in the Holman School District. 29% of them are a half acre to 1 acre in size. 21% are assessed from $50 to $100,000 per acre. And the Village of West Salem has the highest value average at $120,595 per acre. That's pretty obvious because the subdivision that they're working on right now is the Lewis Farm. It's right on the lake. So that's the one thing that's pretty obvious is anything close to water has a higher assessed value per acre. Gives you an idea. So this slide is meant to give you an idea that we have a real detailed analysis of the data. We've looked at it from school district, from town, from city village, from size, from value. It's all the data is included in your packet. Basically, in the incorporated areas, the four-year average, including a projected average for 2009, is about 147 sites per year. The capacity there is at 7 years. I wouldn't say that's good, but it's much better than what we'll see below. The four-year projected average of lots in the towns is 112 sites per year. At 1,373 lots, that capacity is 12 years. That's difficult. It's problematic. But if you look at the projection for this year, 2009, at 31 sites, that's 44 years of capacity. That last number is meant to shock. It's very important that we understand that this is an issue that we're going to have to deal with. And I think that's pretty close to it. Okay. This tabular data, I think, is important that you can take a look at your own specific areas that you serve. We tried to get as much information in two pages as we could, and I have to really give Brian props on the data here that he did a real nice job of getting it for you by value, by size. It gives you an idea that it's not, again, it's not picky. There's sizes all across the spectrum. There's values all across the spectrum, and it's in almost all of the communities that we have. Now, I think, you know, we can't assume that it's going to be 31 sites per year forever, but we also can't assume that 112 sites per year or 147 sites per year is what we're going to get back to. We had a pretty good boom of construction in 05, 06, 07. So somewhere in the middle of this is where we're going to go. And are people going to be more conservative in building new houses in the future? Are they going to start to spend that money again and we get a lot of these large houses that we start here in a couple of years when the economy picks up? We'll start to figure that out as we start to see this data progress from the baseline of this year and the years to come.
Charlie, we had that study, I don't know if it was Carl or somebody, looked at the payback for residential versus commercial versus industrial. Can you comment on that real briefely?
Okay, that was a cost of community services study that was done in the town of Holland. And just about every land use, including agricultural residential, paid for itself. It was a ratio that was below one, so it was there was received more revenue in taxes than the study felt that they cost in services, except for residential, which was a 1.12, so a 12% higher in cost of public services in the town of Holland specifically. But if you've seen cost of community services studies done across the country, most of them come in a very close proximity to each other, for 1.14, 1.2, 1.08. So it's more than, it costs more to provide services to residential development than it does bring in revenue.
Chair Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Charlie, I remember having a conversation with you when we started the comprehensive plan process.
Really?
Many years ago, that was.
Better memory than me.
And it seemed like we were ballparking 1,000, 1,200, something
yes.
like that. We were concerned about the number of empty lots at that point. So I just want to make sure that you know publicly that you have shocked me. I am stunned by this data and really concerned about it. And I appreciate the work that went into collecting it. And I think it is very valuable to have this information and have it documented, as disturbing as it is. So I'm saying that kind of as a preamble. That's my frame of references. I honestly don't remember when we started comp plan, but it was a few years ago.
Yeah.
And
Can I interrupt you for a second,
yeah.
Tara? Knowing this information, had you known this when you did the comprehensive planning process, and I direct this both Tara and Charlie, would you have done things differently or come to different conclusions?
I don't know that the comp plan process would have been changed. I think I will say very honestly, sitting here right now, I want tomorrow night to have a special meeting and put a moratorium on having more development of lots. I mean, that's kind of the knee jerk is, how did we let this happen? Because it's happened over time. So from my perspective, the difference would be for this body and the policy making work that we have an obligation to do as it relates to the development of land.
But
not on the comprehensive plan side necessarily.
I would highly recommend against any knee-jerk reactions.
Yeah.
We're working with the Builders Association, and I think we can maybe come up with some good ideas that they're willing to propose for discussion. And obviously, this is baseline data.
Right, and
it's going to take us some years to understand.
Good. It's not knee-jerk on my part, because that was what I said to you in that meeting however many years ago, was
right.
We should put a stop to developing more parcels now because we have an abundance of them. But that's not really what I wanted to talk about. But to your question, Steve, I don't think we would have changed the comprehensive plan work that we did. It might have reinforced I can't remember what term we used for those restrictions that we put on the development of land, both commercial and residential. The recommendations. We worked at that, changing that terminology, didn't we? But I want to check with you, Charlie, on a couple things. You said you're meeting with Rockland tomorrow night.
Yep.
Will you be sharing this data with all municipalities in the course of next, hopefully recent?
We'll be attempting to do that, and they're also sharing their data with us. We get the building permit trends from them. The county and the unincorporated areas come from Jeff's office,
okay.
And then the building permit trends in the incorporated areas come from them. So there's a constant discussion.
So I just think it's really important that municipal elected officials see this data as soon as possible as well.
Tara, we will be talking about this at the collaboration conference in August.
Excellent. So then just a couple other quick questions. Do you know off the top of your head, Charlie, when you take all of La Crosse County, what the percentage of total land distribution is by incorporated and unincorporated to put these numbers in perspective?
Well, I don't know that, but it's significantly less in the incorporated areas. The land distribution is trying to pull that out of the comp plan in my head, and I think we have 300,000 plus acres in the county,
right.
200,000 plus in ag land, and I think we have around 40,000 acres that are developed, but that doesn't say what's incorporated or unincorporated.
Right. Okay, well, at some point, can we pull
okay.
that out? Because I think that would be helpful to understand. You know, you said the incorporated areas the trends look better, but it would be helpful to know how much of the 300,000 acres is in incorporated land versus unincorporated.
Okay.
And then lastly, the school districts, and I just want to understand the data that you have given us on that last page shows by school district. Is that just another way to cut the data, or is there some special impact for school districts that's different for municipalities or for the county?
It's a different way to cut the data,
okay.
Definitely, but the school districts have to be aware of this. I mean, they've got a plan for enrollment, et cetera, and,
yep.
and they're actually some of the best data keepers. When I go to the school district and ask for data, I'm usually pretty happy.
Nice.
So.
Okay. And then my last comment is to clarify, I'm on the moratorium thing that I said earlier, because I caught a glimpse of Dick Miles sitting here after I said that. I just want to, this lives, the responsibility for whatever the county decides to do with this data will come out of Planning Resources and Development Committee. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
Right.
And I don't serve on that committee. I just want to make sure for the record that I say that. Thank you.
Well, one point that I really want to make is this is not anti-development discussion. This is really pro-development discussion, in that we have to make sure that our developers are successful. We don't want our developers not to be successful. I mean, we want them to win at the game that they're playing. We want them to do well, and we want our residents to get good developments, good quality, well-planned developments. So part of this is taking this data and understanding how this affects development. I mean, Brian and I are not only the planning department, we're also the economic development department of La Crosse County. So that's important to note, that this is our goal is successful development.
And that they have, that the builders were who you shared this data with even before it came here, I think that's appropriate. I think that's great. They need to see this, and that's where the solution needs to come from. I agree.
Charlie, the way you explained this to me the other day, I found really helpful in terms of from the perspective of a developer putting in a development and then somebody puts one in next door to them or whatever. Can you do that little talk with the board? Because I think that really
sure.
kind of puts a nice perspective on it.
Does everybody know where Country Estates is? It's in the town of Holland. It's a subdivision off of McHugh Road and Highway 35, close to their high school. Country Estates started in around, you know, again, my memory, but
93.
Oh, okay. There you go. 74. I was six. But anyway. the last one that was done was Country Estates 4, correct me if I'm wrong, and that was kind of kicked off in 98, 99, somewhere on there. But at the same time, another subdivision was kicked off here and another subdivision was kicked off there. If you look at Country Estates on that map, it's now 10 years old, Country Estates 4. And Country Estates 1, Pine Lane, is plenty old. There's still plenty of vacant lots in the Country Estates subdivision because everybody wants to be in the newest, brightest, best. And the problem is infill development is efficient. It's efficient for social. It's efficient for the developers that own those lots, but it's also efficient for us as governments to serve because those public facilities are already in. But if we continue to create this supply that is running rampant, and you can tell my opinion here, take it with a grain of salt, but if we continue to increase the supply, we're not going to get that infill development. Now, Country Estates is an example to get you thinking rural. It's town of Holland, no septic, or no sanitary sewer, no wells. It's septic and well. So the subdivider basically put in pavement. You go into that subdivision, you buy a lot, you buy the road to your house. There's a few local neighborhood parks, but everything else that family needs to live has got to be provided by the public because the developer provided some pavement. Now, if you think about this on the scale of an urban, and you'll see if you go look at the map, there's plenty of urban lots in here. Sewer, water, library, you know, all of those public facilities that were put in, many of them by the developer in those urban settings, are not infilling. And so that's one of the reasons why we have an issue with our taxes and significantly complaints from the public about their taxes, is this sprawling development pattern that we're not infilling these existing lots. Is that what you were looking for?
That, and also you had explained the developers make their money on those last couple lots. They pay their bills with the first ones.
Yep, that's.
But if they can't sell those last couple, then they don't make their profit, because people are going, as you say, to the newest ones. They want to go there.
And the carrying costs, I mean, getting the money, the financing to do the development by the developer is, if you talk to them, is really where their costs are. Yeah, they got to put the improvements in, they got to put the infrastructure in, but they got to pay for that, and they got to finance it. And obviously, by the report that you got tonight from Clifton Gunderson, that's a big part of our operations, is understanding the financing of our operations. And so if they're carrying those costs for longer periods of time because the development is not filling in, their costs are skyrocketing because of the cost of interest, not just principal. So that's another issue of financial, you know, feasibility for the developer.
Got a lot of people on the list. Next up is Brad Paff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Charlie. I'm going to play devil's advocate for a second, so please bear with me. You talk economics 101, and I love econ. You claim that due to the large supply of lots, it depresses land prices. If I'm a young homeowner with a young family and I'm looking for a home, tell me why having a lot of lots on the marketplace is not good for my family so I can get a house that's affordable so I can send my kids to a good school. That's the American dream.
Sure. Well, the affordability is not just what you pay for that house up front. It's also what you pay for it long term, and that's the taxes.
You should run for office. That's pretty good.
I'm sorry. No, thank you.
I got a couple more. But let me ask you this then, Economics 101. So if we took these lots off the market, would land prices go up? Would housing prices go up?
If you look at other models, when that supply goes down, which if you look at urban growth boundaries and things like that where planning has reduced the supply,
right.
The prices have gone up and the value of the land has gone up. And I have a strong opinion here, but
it's all right.
The value of land is pretty low. Even at $120,000 per acre, which, you know, I'm looking at that going,
right.
I could never afford it.
I couldn't
but,
either.
I think the value of land in many of our municipalities in La Crosse County is pretty low.
Well, let me ask you that, because you break out the incorporated and the unincorporated, mm-hmm. and I think that's very good, and I thank mm-hmm. you for doing that. When it comes to the incorporated total of 1,100 lots, how many of those subdivisions with 1,100 lots use public TIF dollars?
Not very many.
Okay.
TIFs are not made
for residential
for unplatted residential. So
okay.
Speculation. Now, like in Rockland's case, they're already platted. That's an existing site, and it could even be considered blighted. But so a TIF district might be an option there. But for the most part, I think, what is the number, Brian? 35%, the maximum residential you can have in a mixed use TIF is 35%.
Okay.
All other TIFs, it's lower than that even.
Okay, let me just follow up then. So the unincorporated, it's my understanding, now the state changed this law a couple years ago, but I don't believe the unincorporated can have the power to use TIF either.
They
you
do.
Know,
they there do. Is an egg TIF.
But an agriculture TIF, but not for a residential TIF.
You can have a certain percentage of residential development in an egg TIF.
Okay.
It's a small percentage. Is it 25? Or is it still 35?
Okay, 35. Okay. All right. You mentioned a couple times that the county is providing services to these cul-de-sacs. And that's a fair comment. Can you talk to me what services are being provided by the county to those cul-de-sacs? Because I ask this. Does the sheriff's department routinely travel cul-de-sac roads, or do they travel county highways?
I'll have to refer you to the sheriff's department on that. I guess I would say I'm...
If they're called for service, they better show up at the cul-de-sac.
But do they patrol it?
I didn't... specifically say county provided services. These are public services,
right,
that I'm talking about. School bus has to go there.
Right.
If you send a plow truck, you can send a large truck down the highway, but you can't send that large truck in the cul-de-sac.
Okay.
So you actually have a lot of public trucks that are going a lot of highway miles with their plow up to get to a subdivision where then they can put their plow down.
And I'm nitpicking and I'm playing devil's advocate.
Okay.
But generally these are town roads, so it'd be town yes. snow plows.
That's correct.
That I know it's tax dollars.
Yep.
I understand that.
And the cost of community services study that we referred to refers to all of those costs, not just the county.
Not just the county.
Yes.
Right. And that's fair. Okay. Well, thank you. And thank you for the work. I think it's outstanding work and it's very helpful for all of us.
Tom Rauch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have two items. Number one, I served on that comp plan steering committee also for a number of years, and the way I would look at this, I think, Charlie, correct me if I'm wrong, that the comp plan probably would not have changed very much, if any at all, if we'd had this data. What would be affected is what was developed subsequently, and that was called the implementation effort, and this has the potential to affect future implementation of those comp plans, both ours and the town's, as they exist. So the way we describe things may not have varied that much, but still what we do with that comp plan could be affected by this. I have a question for you, and that is on the matrix data sheet, the parcels by municipality, and I guess on the school district side you also mentioned that. The land value per acre has very, very wide range of possibilities there. What really is that value? Is that the assessment? That's the assessment value right out of the assessment books?
Right.
Okay. So it's the assessor that's put that value on, and it may or may not sell for that, but that is the value that the property owner is paying taxes incrementally each year.
That's correct.
Okay, thanks.
Don Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Tara asked most of the questions I was going to ask, but I was going to ask Charlie, you've said you've shared this with the Builders Association, but if somebody comes in that really isn't affiliated with them that much and really wants to start a development, will you or Mike or somebody show them this data and try and steer them away from it, or how would you approach that?
Well, I think that's more of a policy decision. I mean, we'll certainly show them the data, and they make decisions for themselves. But if we're going to start affecting how they and how you make land use decisions, that's something that you have to have a conversation about, make some decisions. It's not our role to start to make land use decisions, you know, right now based on, you know, baseline data. That's really direction that we need to get from you at some point.
But you share this with them and show them what the status is.
Well, I would assume if I'm a banker and I'm, you know, going to give a mortgage to somebody to do a development, that this data is going to be important to me. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, we'll try to share it with whoever we can.
Okay. Thank you.
Andrea Richmond.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Charlie, I have a question. You know, we always hear the statement the city of La Crosse is landlocked. I guess I'm surprised that we have 205 vacant lots. Does your department have the technology to break that down of the 205, whether they are privately owned or City La Crosse owned?
We don't. We tried very hard not to have any public property in these lots. We went through the data a number of times. Am I going to promise that there's zero lots that say, you know, Village Holman on them? No, but okay. We went through it significantly, and they should all be privately owned.
Wonderful. Okay. Thank you.
Audrey Cotter.
Thank you. Going back to the questions in relation to the development of the comprehensive plan, I think that this information could have been useful in strengthening the plan, I think, to some degree. What we dealt with and what we're going to continue to deal with, I think, is the need for education for people to understand the impact of their right in ownership of a piece of land to do what they choose to do with it. Because we ran into that in a very significant way where the the farmers say, well, it's my kids don't want to be on the farm, and therefore I should have the right to be able to sell it. They sell it to the developer, and then, of course, the developer thinks that they're going to make their money fairly quickly without realizing the impacts it's going to have on the general tax base and on the how effective the development is going to evolve. And with the couple of cases that Charlie highlighted where they are likely to be in receivership, is there any possibility or even a value in considering rezoning them back? Are the roads in for these full plat, so that as we see all these little lines in the maps that you've shown us, those roads are actually in there then? So
yeah, maybe if Linda, you could go back to the Rockland one. That yeah, this is Rivendell, and this is Rockland. If you see Rockland, you can see the lighter color under the lines, the dark lines. Those are the roads. They put everything in except for the bottom one, close to the interstate, and the far east one with a little connector. So everything else is in, and that includes sewer and water.
So there's really no going back on it then.
Right. In the next one, if you go to Rivendell, they actually did some phased planning, and you can see the farmland to the north of those two kind of cul-de-sac bulbs. Those streets would, in the future, go further north up to that county trunk highway. So at least they didn't put roads in all the way up to the highway and plat, you know, so that's it's a large phase.
So you're saying that the sort of the grayish, lighter grayish green area north of the area that is platted is also part of the development, that area?
That's correct.
Wow.
So you see the roads in here, here, and here.
Yeah. There's a real challenge there.
We also have a few plats that have been approved but haven't been recorded. So they wouldn't be subdivisions that would show up on our data, but they've been approved. It's just a matter of the developer taking off and running with them.
So, yeah, I just wanted to draw attention to the need for education. And I presume the bankers will not be quite so ready to lend the money either for new developments. But we have a big responsibility here with what we issue in permits. Thank you.
Sharon Hampson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This might be naive, but is there a way that you or that we as a county or we as municipalities could work with developers and take some of those lots and change them to retail, industrial, or agriculture? Because, you know, more of a mixed use.
Sure.
Because I think these are stupid little developments where you have to drive 15 miles to go to the grocery.
You're
going to
get yourself in the paper again.
That's fine. I'm used to it.
That's a really nice segue, because one of the next things we're going to do is we're going to do this baseline data for commercial, for retail, for industrial. I mean, that's, from an economic development standpoint, it's going to be very important to understand that. However, unfortunately, I think what you're going to see is the numbers for those developments are also similar. I mean, so we have 800 acres of annexation to the village of Holman that is mostly commercial, light industrial. You know, we have some needs that we've identified as a staff in large lot industrial, but everything else, I think our numbers are like what they were with the residential. We thought they were 1,200, and we're going to be a little surprised when we get to the actual for all of those also. So I don't think that's a perfect solution. I think we've got to look at being very creative with some solutions from here on forward.
Okay, thanks.
Ann Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this is very interesting and of concern, but I think we have to be careful that we don't panic and come across as Big Brother.
Yep.
This is America. So I think we have to be careful with what we do.
Ralph Geary.
Thank you. Charlie, do we know what the numbers are like in other counties?
No.
Well, if you can ask around, and at some future point, if you get some information, you know, like...
You've asked me that question before, Ralph, and I've asked around, and there isn't an awful lot of study going into this right now.
Because, you know, there's like Dunn County or something across from the cities. Well,
the metro...
In the boom times, them lots are getting, you know, everybody out of the Twin Cities is buying them over right. up in that section, and they may have thousands of them. They're half the size of La Crosse County. And are other counties developing strategies like we are now, or...
The only strategy that I see, and we've held this up for the Builders Association to look at, is the Metro Area Builders Association, which surrounds the city of Milwaukee, has developed a database and a clearinghouse of information of lots that are available, of sites that are available, and the style of development in that clearinghouse of information to help themselves as builders and their developers that are members to understand what's available, what price points are out there, and things like that. So that might be something that our Builders Association can do to help them to understand what's out here in La Crosse County better. And if there's a glut of this type, not do more of that type, maybe do a different type. You know, that's the model that I've looked at in the state of Wisconsin. That's in the metro area around Milwaukee.
So if you called your counterparts in... other counties, they wouldn't know in the unincorporated areas how many vacant lots they had?
Probably not.
They'd have to.
They haven't.
They'd
so
have
far.
To gather the data. You'd say.
Right.
Margaret Wood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a little clarification: the people that you are discussing this with and sharing, when you talk about Builders Association, does that also mean real estate agencies that might have a large amount of adjoining land that they would, sell lots and not necessarily build it? You get your own builder. And does it, I think Supervisor Meyer asked this too, someone who, starts out with buying one farm and now has accumulated five adjoining farms, can you see that that's a single owner who probably is thinking of development? Is that the group you're talking to, or just the Builders Association?
I haven't talked to anybody else yet. The Realtors, La Crosse Area Realtors Association, is on the list that we'd like to discuss it with. As far as the landowners that look like speculators, if you will, that's a little bit more difficult to just assume things. And that, again, that would be more of a take the aerial photo, look at the name on the aerial photo, and go, well, I think it's this. Rather than, the way we've done this, which is actually data collection and cross-referencing tables. So that's going to be more of a vernacular, more of a,
I see. And then in terms of the county's plans, do you think this information impacts the idea of having a county assessor? And what about our Lakeview plan that we're thinking about?
Well, the county assessor issue is... quicksand that I'm not interested in stepping into tonight.
Okay.
It should heavily affect our discussion of the master plan on the county farm. We're talking 1,000 residential lots that are 1,000 residential sites or 1,000 residential facilities in the county farm itself, and obviously the direction from you so far has been not to compete with private developers. Well, that's a pretty strong, statement at this point about that. So that's an issue, However, looking at that style of development, that's a very efficient way to serve 1,000 lots. And so can we improve our efficiency with what we have currently? That's the idea of the county farm, is to provide those services more efficiently and provide a good quality of life for the residents of the county. Both very good goals, both things that we need to look at when we're talking about solutions to this, but where and when? And obviously this has got to have an effect on that.
Thank you.
Jim Burns.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick comment on our market area. I know we're concerned about La Crosse County, and we should be. I also think it would be helpful or beneficial to do a complete market. And I mean, our market is not just La Crosse County. We have Houston County, which is part of our metro area. We have Vernon County, And we have other places, not just La Crosse County. So it'd be interesting to maybe collaborate and share this information with other neighboring counties, even if they're in Minnesota. I think it would be certainly beneficial. And then a couple questions I had. You touched on it a little bit with the Lakeview Industrial Park. I know that primarily our the land has been earmarked for industrial purposes. I guess my question is, because I don't see La Crosse County on the list. The Village of West Salem has annexed land, or continues to annex land as our development progresses. Correct.
Correct.
And so, even though La Crosse County doesn't have any vacant lots, certainly there are currently, in this number, in the number that you showed us with West Salem, there are a number of those lots that are a result of the development, the agreement that we have with the
no. The county farm, there are no subdivided lots that are residential.
Okay. So there are no subdivided... Okay. So the only lots that we have that are vacant are industrial.
Correct.
And we haven't... Even though our master plan, I want to say 5 or 6 years ago, earmarked land
right.
for residential development, we actually haven't...
It's not in this data.
It's not in this data. Okay.
Right. Okay. That's an important point. This is lots that are subdivided and very likely have roads, sewer, water, whatever public improvements they need that are already run. Because once they're subdivided, typically the subdivider doesn't wait to put those improvements in. So these are just the lots that are available now.
That are ready to build on.
If you want to use that term, shovel ready.
Okay.
So...
And I applaud your, I don't know if this was your, is this idea came from you to analyze the vacant lots, or who, I mean, this is a great idea, and I like the fact that you want to analyze industrial commercial lots as well.
Joe Veenstra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a question about some of the data on here. If you look on the sheet that is titled Vacant Residential Parcels by Municipality, I was sort of curious about $0 to $500 valued lots. What are those, and how come there are 273 in the unincorporated areas and 79 in the incorporated areas? And I noticed looks like about 60 or more of those are in Bangor and Holman. So it does seem to be a wide disparity between the sort of urban developed areas having these none of them really, and the I guess the smaller areas having a large number of these really low valued lots. Can you tell us what those are?
Well, it has a lot to do with use value assessment. You can subdivide the property and put in the improvements, and basically the lots are ready to sell. But if you're taking a crop of rye or hay or whatever you say you're taking a crop of off, it's one of those loopholes that allows a developer to pay use value assessment on ag land that's never going to be ag land. It was a loophole that was attempted to be addressed in this year's budget that didn't get addressed. Again, I have opinions on that, but you know, take that with a grain of salt. But you'll see that more often in the unincorporated areas, because those are more likely to have access to a hay bine or you know, to be able to bale a couple bales of hay off of it and then pay the use value assessment on it. Whether there's mistakes by the assessors on some of them, you know, that's not something that we've done any investigation on, but I think it's obvious that if you had a lot that was $0 to $500 per acre that was for sale, it'd be sold. So
right.
It's,
a county assessor might help do this properly.
Well, no, it's actually
again,
state law.
I
don't know if you caught the Journal Sentinel article a couple weeks ago about this specific issue. We use an example outside of La Crosse County. You know, Clare County, next to their Gander Mountain, they're paying, like, I think the quote was $12.71 an acre for land that is right next to the Gander Mountain that clearly is for commercial, eventual use. It's not a residential, but they're able to get use value on it as ag land and way underpay. So who else is paying? The other property taxpayers that are in that same area. It happens with commercial land. It happens with residential land. You might have all the utilities in and everything, but if you plant a crop and get to call it ag land, that's why you show up in this column.
And that's no matter who the assessor is.
Okay.
That's the law.
That's very interesting. I'm also curious about, I guess this is sort of like data overload, and if we're sort of... it's great. I think it's very interesting, but it makes me kind of wonder if, like, historically we had, I assume that we had similar trends, and this isn't the first time this problem has been encountered by government agencies. So I'm kind of curious how these were handled historically. And I'm also curious if you can tell us what the Builders Association response was with regard to solutions for the problem. I know it's not a monolith, but if you have some information about that, sure. I'd be curious.
Well, I think we have not collected that data in the past, typically. And so if you don't have the data, you don't know there's a problem, you don't really address it. The Builders Association first had a very similar expression to many of you, where their jaws dropped, you know. And I think you have to realize us sitting in a room like this making policy decisions is very different than them sitting in a room going, you know, right now the economy stinks, I've laid off how many guys on my crew, and then they get this type of information that's laid out in front of them. It's not an easy thing to deal with. This is their livelihood. I mean, this is what is paying their bills on a day-to-day basis, and it's not going real well right now. And then you see this, and I think many of them understood that this was happening. This is their business. They've got probably a better understanding of this than we do. But when you don't see the data and you don't see the problem, you don't address it. And so my discussions with them really didn't get into solutions yet. And it was more along the lines of, here's the information, start thinking about it, take it back, digest it. And I think it was pretty apparent to them that this was an issue that needed to be dealt with. But again, there's going to be different opinions in the room, and that's just me reading the room. That's not me saying, okay, what's your opinion, what's your opinion? That's all that is.
Jay Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Great stuff, Charlie. I have one short question. The data I'm looking at for the city of La Crosse, it appears as if you've included parcels that would not be buildable. Is that a true statement?
No, we used a minimum lot size that was buildable based on most codes, which the minimum lot size that we used was 0.12 acres. And so anything larger or anything smaller than 0.12 acres hopefully is not in the data. And again, we've gone through it fairly thoroughly. So if it's less than 0.12 acres, it's not buildable, it's not in the data. If it's more than 0.12 acres, it's with the right codes and the right location, you can build on it.
Okay, then follow-up question. Can you explain then why a few of these lots are in those value columns of $0 to $500 per acre, $500,000 per acre? I understand your explanation when in ag areas, but how in the city of La Crosse does that happen? Or are these kind of on the periphery of the city?
We certainly didn't study why their values were put at that assessed value. That's a lot more in-depth study that would take quite a bit of staff time to do to understand. You'd have to go look at the assessment card and understand why the assessor assessed it at that rate, and then what the reasonings were for putting it at that into that category. We can do that, but that's a real manual review, and this is a much more mechanical or data analysis that we let the computers do the math.
Okay, well that's kind of how I drew that conclusion. I thought some of these parcels must be the size of a postage stamp.
Yep, 0.12 acres is small. Yeah. I mean, what is that? That's 50 by 70, something like that. I mean, it's a small lot.
Thanks, Charlie.
Ralph.
Thank you, Charlie. Well, on the town plans and on our county plan, we've got areas earmarked for residential.
Yep.
So if a developer comes in and purchases some property for a rezoning in that, it falls in our, I'm assuming the town and the county are going to recommend approval.
Correct.
Even if it's 100 lots or something, right?
That's right. If it's consistent with the plan, that's the direction that we've been given at this point.
Tara has a couple questions.
I have one. Back to Supervisor Johnson's question. It seems to me the municipalities would be interested in looking at the three lots, for example, in the city of La Crosse that's under $500 assessed value that, I mean, I'm not sure that the county staff has to spend time doing that. It seems to me municipal staffs would be interested in doing that work for themselves as they work on their own individual plans.
Tom has a follow-up.
Thank you. One of the points we should keep in mind is those under $500 lots aren't necessarily the very small ones. They very well can be within a municipal area, and they can be that use value assessment. If you'd just like to cast your eyeballs on it, go out Highway 16, come on Theater Road, come right under the interstate, right there, just before the Skemp Clinic. All of that guy's taking a harvest of hay off there, and he's paying use value on that property, which you can see the stuff under Road OS there, which is all being marvelously developed to become suddenly really valuable. But right now, it's only farmland. It's right there in the middle of us.
Good example. Anybody else? Charlie, you got their attention tonight. Thank you very much for all your hard work. And Brian. All righty. That gets to future agenda items or any announcements. Anybody have any of those? I got a couple things. First of all, Arlene and Jerry, do you need any help with the picnic at this point? We're getting closer to that.
Yes. I guess I got an email. They would like two people to go on the bus tours.
No, you're talking WCA. Them. I'm talking picnic first.
Oh, the picnic.
That's coming up first.
Everything under control, Steve, with the picnic.
All right, glad to hear it. Okay. Then, yeah, are you taking money for the picnic at this point?
Whenever. I have my purse with me.
Okay. How much per person? What was it?
August 20th.
$12?
We had a quota of 12,000, but I'm working to get that lower. It's not final yet.
Okay, so.
But at a county board meeting, we'll have a dollar amount, and invitations will be ready to go.
Okay, so we don't need money yet, but no. Bring money to the county board meeting next week. Next is, and this is a little belated, but I want to thank Arlene for giving me this. I want to congratulate Jay Johnson for making the cover of Cooley Region Women. If you look around town, you'll find these at various businesses, and if you grab one, I understand Jay is willing to sign autograph copies for anybody who's for a fee, of course. Right. The other famous person tonight, of course, is Brad Paff. Want to congratulate him on his appointment as Farm Services Director. Yeah, really. Tom.
Just a request. Could we have a reminder on the dates for the picnic for WCA and for the collaboration conference, please?
August 20th is the county board picnic, which is the same day as your August county board meeting. The collaboration conference is the following day, August 21st, which is a Friday. That'll be in the morning. And the and Brian, that's it. Is Brian there? Where is that going to be located, the collaboration conference?
Next door at the new
Lunda
TC.
TC facility. And September 13th through 15th is the WCA conference here in La Crosse.
All right. Anybody else have any announcements, questions, comments? That gets us to Bob Kyle, I think, right? Move to adjourn by Bob Kyle, second by Jerry Sobranek. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed no. Carried unanimously.